From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Sheldon Harnick wrote the lyrics for the Broadway hits Fiddler on the Roof and Fiorello. The original cast recording of one of his favorite shows has just been reissued. On today's Fresh Air, we listen with Sheldon Harnick to the reissue of his show, She Loves Me. Also today, poet Sharon Olds reads a couple of very confidential-sounding poems and asks us not to think about whether they're autobiographical. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from trumpeter Jack Walrath, and television critic David Bianculli previews A Very Brady Christmas, a holiday special starring the Brady Bunch. David says that this is one Christmas present he could do without. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is one of Broadway's great lyricists, Sheldon Harnick. With his former collaborator Jerry Bock, Harnick wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, She Loves Me, Tenderloin, and The Apple Tree. Harnick and Bock ended their partnership in 1970 after their musical The Rothschilds. It's been over 10 years since Harnick had a new Broadway show. His last one, Rex, was written with composer Richard Rodgers. In the past few years, Harnick has translated several operettas into English, including The Merry Widow. He's also working on a one-act opera in collaboration with composer Jonathan Tunick, and a musical version of It's a Wonderful Life, which Harnick hopes will open on Broadway after some legal problems are ironed out. Of all his musicals, one of Harnick's favorites is She Loves Me. It opened in April of 1963 and closed 8.5 months later. The cast recording has been long out of print, but it's just been reissued by Polydor.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah. Now today she likes me, ha. And tomorrow, tomorrow, ah. My teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now. My love discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me.
Sheldon Harnick, welcome to Fresh Air. Is this very good news for you that She Loves Me has been reissued? Are you glad to see it back in print again?
Oh, it certainly is. Because along with Fiddler on the Roof, I think it's the favorite show that I've ever been connected with.
It closed after a little over 300 performances.
That's correct.
On Broadway. The liner notes were written by the producer of this reissue, Larry Lash, and he implies that audiences really wanted brassier entertainment than She Loves Me at the time that it opened on Broadway. What was the context that it opened in?
The context meaning other shows?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was 1963. Oh, I don't remember what the other shows were. But I think it's true that She Loves Me is a very literate, rather gentle show. And as some people have called it, caviar, it seemed at the time to have a limited audience that... As a matter of fact, when it closed, I was quite distressed because I loved the show so. And for about 2 years, if I remember correctly, it seemed to be dead, which was both bewildering and depressing. But through the years, it got performances, and I began to get letters. Jerry Bock and I both got letters from companies who performed it saying, we love the show, we love to perform it, and that was gratifying. And over the years, little by little, it's made its way into the mainstream of shows that get performed.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the title song that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
The initial rhymes are really repetitions. She loves me, but she doesn't know it. No, she loves me, but she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it?
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your mind when you're using, say, two its instead of rhyming an it with a sit or an it with a bit, but to reuse that word?
Oh, that's a different kind of rhyme. The rhyme is not it. If you'll notice, the accent is on the prior syllable. show it, know it, and that's done all the time. If it were one word, it would be like action, faction.
Mm-hmm.
So that that's the rhyme is not necessarily on the last syllable. It's where the stress is, and in those cases, the stress is on show and on know.
I like the line, "My teeth ache from the urge to touch her."
Well, that's an extremely personal line. I was trying to use myself as George, and I realized that there are situations with some women where whatever the feelings are, they get me right in the back of the teeth. Now, I had a friend who, not having had that experience, he said, "What kind of a line is that?" He said, "I love you, and my foot hurts." You know, so it was very personal to me, and I just hoped that other people either would identify with it or at least understand what I was saying.
I want to play the opening number that you wrote the lyrics for "She Loves Me." This is called "Good Morning, Good Day." But before we hear it, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the function that this song had to serve within the play, because opening numbers are really important. They have to set the tone for everything that's going to follow, and they frequently have to introduce the characters as well.
Right.
What are some of the functions this song had to play when you were writing it?
Well, I guess the main thing that the song did was to set the tone of the show. And for good or for bad, it's a gentle tone. It's not a razzle-dazzle opening number. Also, the number lyrics and music interweave with some of Joe Masteroff's dialogue. So it was really a delineation of character at the top of the show, the people we were going to be spending the next 2 hours with. And mostly it was that. It was getting you to know them, getting you to get a sense of the fact that they're comrades in this shop that they all work in.
Okay, let's hear a part of "Good Morning, Good Day" with the lyrics by my guest, Sheldon Harnick.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this beautiful day? Isn't this a beautiful morning?
Very.
Hey, see, boss, how's this?
That's a very elegant pose, but is all that elegance necessary?
And why not? I represent Marichex, don't I? We're not a butcher shop or a hardware store. We're a perfumery, and that means we're
stylish.
That's it.
With a quiet dignity.
Yes, and we get the tilt of our hats right.
That's right.
When I ride my bike, people see what Marichek's like. So I think it's very important that I look my best. Here comes Miss Ritter.
Miss Ritter.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me and I'll quit my...
You know, listening to that, it's easy for me to understand why you're doing operettas now and one-act operas. I seem to hear a connection between some of the writing that you did for She Loves Me.
Right. I'm sure I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I think I was leaning towards that kind of through-composed style where it would be either sung all the way through or a mix of music and dialogue that totaled up to almost a complete musical experience.
When you're writing a lyric, do you find that you frequently throw out the first few versions of it before you come up with the one you like, or are you lucky enough to hit on it the first time?
Well, what I find, it's funny you should say that, I haven't thought about this for a while, but what I find is quite often the first version of a lyric, it's not that the lyric won't be technically good, and the idea may even be good, but what I find is I don't know the character well enough yet, so that as my acquaintance with the character deepens, then I will look at that lyric and no longer be satisfied with it and think, no, that's really not what the character would say at this time, so that I throw it out and start over again. And if I'm lucky, I'm able to salvage some of the better lines from the song.
Do you allow yourself to use the same rhyme twice in different songs?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean.
Say you used a rhyme 15 years ago in a song.
Oh.
And those particular words will work just fine in a song you're working on now. Will you rule it out because you already used it once?
If it's a trick rhyme, yeah, I'll rule it out. I try and avoid that. Sometimes, of course, you don't remember. What's more difficult, I once asked Ogden Nash, a man I loved, and I loved his work. I was his assistant for a television show years ago called Art Carney Meets Peter and the Wolf, so I got to meet him and work with him. And I said, what happened? Well, how do you feel if you write a rhyme that you feel is original with you, and then you hear another song, an earlier song where that rhyme has been used? What, do you have to go back and rewrite? And Ogden started laughing. He said, oh my, he said, I write rhymes and I'm so proud of myself. I think they're fresh and new. And then I find out that Larry Hart wrote them 20 years ago. And he said, all I can tell you is if you feel that you've created that rhyme, then use it. He said, there's no reason to change it just because someone else has. And as a matter of fact, I've started reading poetry late in my life, in the last 8 years or so. I've been going through poetry, and I find with Browning and with Lowell and people like that, they've used all of those complicated rhymes a century before we did.
And that doesn't bother you, though?
No.
What are you learning from reading poetry that applies to songs?
I think what I'm learning is that the great poets, not even the great poets, the minor poets, all good poets, have a genuine care for using the right word in the right place. I think that comes through, and it makes you want to, it inspires you to do the same, to be careful, to write with as great care as possible so that you really express what it is that you yourself are feeling.
You never write pop songs, at least not that I know of. All of your songs are written in the context of a show.
Right. I learned very early that was not my talent. I was quite disappointed when I discovered that, because when I came to New York from Chicago, it was with the idea of being another Irving Berlin, writing for the theater and having songs come out of it that were pop hits. And little by little, as I talked to people and as I looked around and as I was honest with myself, I thought, no, that's not the way I write. So I was hoping that ultimately some of the songs from the shows would become standards, and that's what happened. There's been a few.
Well, what did make you realize that your gift was for writing songs within shows and not just pop songs?
Well, I think there were two experiences, I think. One, I hadn't been in New York too long when I had four songs in an off-Broadway review called the Shoestring Review, and they got very nice press. So I was invited up to meet a publisher in the pop field, and I played him my stuff. And after I did, they said, well, your work is too filled with ideas. It's not simple enough for what we want is something much simpler. And I thought, I guess that's true, but I write complicated most of the time, or at least I do try and put ideas in. And I thought, well, if that's the case, that's the case. Then the other experience was, after I had met Jerry Bock and we started to work together, there was a period when we didn't particularly have a show to work on, so we worked on a lot of what were meant to be pop songs. And we didn't sell any of them. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and thought, well, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm. Before you started working with composer Jerry Bock, you were writing music for your own songs. And I think it was Yip Harburg, the lyricist who's probably best known for writing lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, who told you to stick to lyrics. Was that good advice?
Yes. Well, it certainly facilitated my career. What he did was to tell me that, in his estimation at that time, this was the early 50s, that there were more capable theater composers than there were capable theater lyricists. So what he actually said was, if you can facilitate your career by agreeing to collaborate with other composers instead of writing music yourself. And that's what I did. Shortly before he died, as a matter of fact, he told a good friend of mine, Madeline Guilford, who was a very close friend of his, my name came up in a conversation they were having, and Yip said, I wonder if I did that young man a disservice. He said, his music was fine, but I wanted him to get ahead faster, so I wanted him to work with other people, and I hope I didn't steer him away from writing his own music.
I think one of the things that would be really nice about writing lyrics to somebody else's music is that you've got a variety of lines to write to. That you've got, if the music's coming first, you have somebody else's lines to fit your words and rhymes to, and that there'd be less of a possibility of getting stuck or of rewriting the same song?
Well, there's always the possibility of getting stuck. But what is wonderful about writing with someone else, there's two things that come to mind. One is that music, although people consider it as an abstract art form, music to me is very concrete. Music says certain things, so that when I hear a piece of music, when Jerry used to give me a tape with a lot of new music on it, music suggests ideas, music suggests emotions and moods, and I would find myself getting ideas for lyrics that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't heard those pieces of music. So that was wonderful. The other thing is, as you were implying, one of the difficult things to create in writing a lyric is the form of the lyric, or at least it's difficult for me. Maybe other people don't have that problem. But to create a fresh form is not always easy. And when someone gives you a piece of music, the form is there. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the other things, singability and clarity and rhyme and things like that.
Stephen Sondheim, back at his lecture on lyrics that he gave at the New York Y years ago, this was in the 1970s, said that you were one of his favorite lyricists and that he liked your work for its grace, its charm, and its perfection of setting. And I think that perfection of setting has really been an important one for you when I think of the different kinds of settings you've had to write for. Fiorello, which is about New York politics. Fiddler on the Roof, which is set in an Eastern European shtetl. I mean, those are two really different extremes that you had to write lyrics for.
Mm-hmm. I do my research, and as a matter of fact, I think that accounts for the least successful show that I did.
Which one?
The first one with Jerry Bock. It was called The Body Beautiful. And I accepted the show because I was very hungry to get a show on Broadway, but it was not the show I should have done. It was about boxing. And boxing was a sport and a milieu that I really had almost no interest in. So although I did my research, my heart wasn't in it.
Well, Fiddler on the Roof, which was a very unusual setting, the Eastern European shtetl, was one of your most successful shows, one of the most successful shows on Broadway, probably. This was one of the shows that you initiated the idea for.
Right. A friend had sent me a novel by Shalom Aleichem, a book called Wandering Star, about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring all over Russia and Poland. And I loved it. I gave it to Jerry Bock to read. He loved it. And we gave it to Joe Stein to read. Joe read it, and he said, it's too sprawling. It covers 40 years. It has a cast. I mean, it has about 80 characters. It's just too big. He said, but the writing is wonderful, and it's very inherently musical. Why don't we look for more things by Shalom Aleichem? So we did, and we found the Tevye stories, which we then optioned and began the project ourselves.
Well, I want to talk with you a little bit more about Fiddler on the Roof and your other shows, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics for such shows as Fiorello, Fiddler on the Roof, and She Loves Me. She Loves Me has just been reissued, and it's been remixed as well. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick is my guest. We were talking before about songs that do and don't have lives outside of the show, and you said you always wanted to write songs that would have a life outside of the show. I think the songs in Fiddler on the Roof certainly did, and I think especially of Sunrise Sunset, about how many weddings that
right.
song has been sung at. Have you been to weddings where they sang that song?
I've not only been to weddings where they've sung that song, but I have a number of friends who've asked me and my wife to sing that song. For instance, Alan Alda's daughter got married, and one of his daughters got married, and Margie and I sang there. So we've sung the song ourselves at a number of weddings.
Can I ask you to recite the lyrics from the song?
Or the opening. I think I can remember the first chorus anyway.
Okay.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall? Wasn't it yesterday that they were small? Sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears.
What came first in that song when you were writing it?
The music. And I remember it very vividly. Jerry Bock was living in New Rochelle at the time, and I would take the train out there. We would go into his basement where he had a studio. And he played me the music for Sunrise, Sunset. And I was so moved by it. I had the experience of having, I've used this phrase describing this experience before, I had the experience of having lyrics kind of crystallize on the notes. It came out very fast, very rapidly. And we were both so thrilled with it that we called Jerry's wife, Patty. We said, come down. She ran down to the basement, and we played it, and she wept.
That was a good sign, huh?
Yes.
Did you learn about writing songs in settings by some of the early work that you did for industries? You wrote a lot of industrial shows, I think, for places like Esso and Nabisco, Buick. What did you write songs for them?
They had an interesting policy. They used standard music, and my job was to take the material they did, the points they wanted to make. Most of the shows I did were for salesmen, either introducing a new product or a new slogan or just making them more enthusiastic about what they were doing, so that my job was fitting this material into existing music. They felt that it was enough to give their audiences the message without asking them to absorb new melodies as well. And as a matter of fact, later they got sued for this because I didn't know at the time that they hadn't been paying the composers. As a matter of fact, I did a long lyric to the Meredith Willson's song Trouble, and somebody who was in the industrial show that we did was a friend of Meredith Willson's, and he called Meredith Willson not to complain, but just to say what fun it was doing this new lyric to Meredith Willson's tune. And Wilson, of course, was shocked. He said, "What do you mean? Nobody asked me for my permission." But what that experience did for me was to refine my craft, because especially for an industrial show, everything had to be done with the greatest possible clarity, the greatest possible economy, and the greatest possible effectiveness. So it was learning to hone my skills.
Do you remember any of the lyrics you wrote for those industrials?
Oh, no, that was...
too long ago. Huh?
That's too long ago. That's about 30 years ago.
When you're looking at a book that you're going to be writing the lyrics for, how do you know where the songs go? What makes the place in a Broadway book for a song?
Well, there can be a number of different places. One, of course, which we're all taught, is that one looks for the emotional high point of the scene, where the emotion is so strong that the words want to start soaring. Instead of just being spoken, you want the addition of music to deepen the emotion. But also, there can be a spot, for instance, in Fiorello. As Jerome Wideman wrote the book, he had a scene in a political clubhouse where the men were playing poker. And I thought, oh my, I played a lot of poker in the Army, and I remembered a lot of the colorful lingo that went with poker, and I thought, I want to use that lingo for a colorful lyric. So I spoke to Jerome Wideman, and I said, I want to borrow some of your lines, and I want to change a large part of this poker game into music. And he said, be my guest. He was very generous, so I did that.
You remember any of the lyric? This is politics and poker.
This is politics
about, right?
And politics and poker. Well, the first part was all that King Betts. I panic whenever anybody asks me to remember one of my lyrics. But it's
feel like an imposter when that happens.
They'll see right through me. They'll see that I have this small boy who comes in and does all my lyrics for me.
Well, you're working on a lot of new projects now.
Yeah.
Would you tell us about one of them that you're really looking forward to?
I have no favorites.
Okay.
One of the ones that the most frustrating, with composer Joe Raposo, we did an adaptation of the old film It's a Wonderful Life. And what we did, everything we were supposed to do. Our producers did. They did a copyright search, and we discovered later that there were very bizarre copyright problems, problems that none of us expected, and so we're still trying to iron those out. I hope we'll iron them out soon, because we've tried the show at the University of Michigan, where it went wonderfully well, and then this past summer we did it way off the beaten track at Wagon Wheel Theater in Indiana, a splendid non-equity company, because I wanted to see it, and we wanted to do it in a setting where we didn't think there'd be an injunction or anything. So we did it, and it was, again, it was quite successful. It's ready for Broadway, and if we can just clear up those problems, we'll have, I think, a wonderful show to bring in.
How have things changed in terms of trying out a show before bringing it to Broadway?
Well, it's just so costly to take a show on the road. It may add, I don't know, maybe another $1 million to the budget. It's just everything costs so much. Traveling, transportation, the cost of the musicians, the cost of the actors, the per diems on the road, everything just costs so much that, as we've seen, shows arrive now from England where they're tried out. Of course, the English don't consider it a tryout. They consider it their theater. But in many ways, our producers consider it a tryout, that it's much cheaper to mount a show over there. And they, so if something's a hit, then it they risk bringing it in. Otherwise, shows tend to arise in other cities around this country, and then a producer will get to see them and then, again, risk bringing them in. There are fewer and fewer shows that seem to originate on Broadway, which is a shame.
Do you miss Broadway when you don't have a show that's open there?
Well, there's two things about Broadway that no other venue can provide. One is the immediate launching of a show. When you do a show on Broadway, even a flop, people know about it all over the country. And if it's a hit, they may know about it all over the world. Whereas if you start a show that's a success in some other city, little by little, it has to make its way into the news and it has to make its way into the stream of things that get produced. And then, of course, for a writer, the other thing is that the money that comes in for a Broadway success is enough to enable you to devote your life to writing. If you don't have that kind of royalty coming in, then you have to teach or you have to find another profession that will support you to support your writing habit.
You haven't had to do that, have you?
Not since Fiorello.
Right, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
One last question. When you're writing lyrics for a song, where are you? At the piano, at the desk, on the couch, driving in the car?
I'm various places. Where I prefer to be when I start is in a reclining chair. And on a little end table next to the chair is my thesaurus and my rhyming dictionary if I need them. But I like to be quiet and calm and just in a position to think and hoping that the phone won't ring because I'm a compulsive answerer. Then once the lyric is started and it reaches a point where I'm excited about what I'm doing, then it can be on a subway, on a train, walking around the city. In fact, I have to be careful that I don't walk right out into traffic.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
The 1963 musical She Loves Me, with lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, has just been reissued on CD by Polydor. Harnick's other Broadway hits include Fiorello and Fiddler on the Roof. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with British historian John Costello. His new book, Mask of Treachery, has caused quite a stir in England. It charges that British officials lied to the U.S. government about the extent of Soviet penetration of British intelligence, and that the British also hid evidence of the pro-Nazi views of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor during the war. I hope you can join us.
I'm freezing, that's because it's cold out. But still I'm incandescent, and like some adolescent, I'd like to sprawl on every wall I see. She loves me. She loves me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What do you do when you're a confessional poet, but you want to keep your privacy? Coming up, a discussion of that dilemma with poet Sharon Olds. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Holy Trinity, the new album from trumpeter Jack Walrath and his trio. Kevin says the album shows off the two sides of Walrath's music, his years of experience playing with Charles Mingus and Ray Charles, and his musical sense of humor. And television critic David Bianculli warns us about the upcoming Brady Bunch special called A Very Brady Christmas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The judge in the Iran-Contra case this evening issued a sharp rebuke to Oliver North, accusing the former White House aide of threatening massive disclosures of classified documents simply to frustrate the prosecution. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
In a steamy opinion, Judge Gerhard Gesell drastically limited the number of classified documents North may use in his defense at his trial. Gesell noted that he has twice given North a full opportunity to provide a specific list of documents and reasons why those documents would be needed at trial. Both times, said Gesell, North has squandered this opportunity by providing lists of thousands of documents with no real connection to the charges against him. Said the judge, this is a case charging fraud and deceit. It must remain focused on these issues and not be derailed by myriad unrelated issues. Said the judge, quote, there is ample evidence of North's attempt to frustrate the prosecution. The truth is that although duly warned, North, as a tactical matter, has taken an obdurate stand. If it were permitted, there would be no trial, close quote. And so the judge limited North to 300 classified documents in his defense, the same number allowed the prosecution, but only if North can show that those documents are relevant. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The kidnappers of U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins said today they've sentenced him to death as a spy for Israel. The Organization of the Oppressed on Earth released a statement in Beirut saying its decision was also a retaliation for Israeli attacks against Palestinians in the occupied territories. A Yugoslavian military plane carrying supplies for earthquake victims crashed in Soviet Armenia today, killing all seven crew members. It was the second such crash in the international airlift of aid to Armenian earthquake victims. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Today's crash came amid growing tensions in the relief effort. The mountains of concrete rubble from last Wednesday's earthquake still trap thousands of victims, but the chances of finding any of them alive are fading quickly. Government spokesmen haven't revised their initial estimate of 45,000 deaths, but they acknowledge that the number could grow dramatically. The Communist Party newspaper Pravda today said lives were lost because of disorganized rescue efforts. The government paper Izvestia said dangerous overcrowding at Armenian airports caused the Yugoslavian plane crash, as well as yesterday's crash of a Soviet relief plane. 78 soldiers and crew died in yesterday's accident. The Soviet government announced investigations of the two plane crashes. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Three trains collided at the height of rush hour in London this morning. Police say at least 36 people were killed and more than 100 injured in one of Great Britain's worst rail disasters. The accident occurred when a crowded commuter train traveling at 50 miles per hour slammed into the back of a commuter train that had stopped. A freight train then hit some of the wreckage resulting from the first collision. Kevin Lairn was a passenger on board one of the trains.
Just almighty smash. It was like a bomb going off. And the train shuddered along the lines. And next thing we know, there's all this mangled metal all on us. And people buried under rubble and all that. And we was just helping to get people out.
Rescue workers used metal cutters to pry open the rail cars that were strewn across the tracks. Scores of people suffered minor injuries and were treated on the scene. The State Department says that South Africa, Angola, and Cuba will sign a peace protocol tomorrow that should lead to signatures on a full-scale agreement later this month. The agreement, reached after discussions in Brazzaville, the Congo, calls for the withdrawal over 27 months of Cuban troops from Angola and the recognition by South Africa of neighboring Namibia's independence. Stocks fell slightly on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 4 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Jack Walrath's early credits include work with Charles Mingus and Ray Charles, but now Walrath leads his own trio with bassist Chip Jackson and drummer Jimmy Madison. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Walrath is a serious musician who's also a fine musical comedian, and Kevin says this new album shows off the trumpeter's strengths.
Since 1957, when tenor sax colossus Sonny Rollins recorded an epic live set with only bass and drums for company, the trio format has been a recognized test of a horn player's invention and cunning. Trumpeter Jack Walrath takes up the challenge on a new album for the Muse label called Holy Trinity, Holy spelled W-H-O-L-L-Y. The bassist is Chip Jackson and the drummer Jimmy Madison. Here's the trio on Walrath's tune Spherious, based on pianist Thelonious Monk's version of Lulu's Back in Town. The trio setting is such a challenge for horn players, we may forget it's a proving ground for rhythm sections, too. Bassist Chip Jackson may weave a contrapuntal line or solo like a horn player. That leaves drummer Jimmy Madison to sketch out a tune structure even as he prods his mates along. Jack Walrath came up through the band of bassist Charles Mingus, a humorist who'd learned a few things about comedy from Spike Jones. Walrath is a pretty funny guy himself. Like Mingus or Spike Jones, he makes parodies of bad music part of his good music. That's most obvious on I Can't Get Started, which has been a showcase for trumpeters since Bunny Berrigan made it a hit in the late 1930s. Walrath refers to Berrigan's reading and a later one by Dizzy Gillespie, but he doesn't stop there. Switching between muted and open horn and adopting several styles, he rifles through the history of jazz trumpet. It's as if a few incompatible soloists were fighting for access to the mic. Jackson and Madison reply in kind. Such quick changes are typical of a band in which the players leave themselves so exposed. To keep things varied, they'll try most anything, from satire to tender ballads. Walrath's tune Killer Bunnies is a kind of round, you know, like Frère Jacques. A month or so after cutting this record in New York, Jack Walrath was on the road with an English quartet. Before that, he'd recorded with a jazz band from Montana, and since then he cut a Hank Williams tune using Willie Nelson as a sideman. Walrath thrives on variety, so his music never gets stale. If Holy Trinity is his best showcase in a while, it's because this trio affords him the most freedom to do anything that pops into his head.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Jack Walrath's new album, Holy Trinity, on the Verve label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Sharon Olds. Her second book of poems, The Dead and the Living, won the 1985 National Book Critics Circle Award. In her latest collection, The Gold Cell, many of the poems are about being a daughter, mother, and wife. David Levitt wrote, Sharon Olds is enormously self-aware. Her poetry is remarkable for its candor, its eroticism, and its power to move. Sharon Olds has been published in The Atlantic, The Nation, and The New Republic. She's taught at Brandeis, Columbia, and New York University, where she's now the director of creative writing. Sharon Olds writes poems that sound very confidential, very personal, yet she's reluctant to discuss if they're autobiographical. I asked her to read her poem, I Go Back to May, 1937.
I go back to May, 1937. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, with the wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They are about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You are going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You are going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it, her hungry, pretty, blank face turning to me, her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, his arrogant, handsome face turning to me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body. But I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you are going to do, and I will tell about it.
So is that poem about your parents, or do you prefer to think of it as a poem about somebody's parents, just a poem about parents but not necessarily yours?
I don't know why, really, but if one were to be able to need to write poems that happen to seem as if they were by anybody or for anybody, or whose desire to share experience was such that the biographical side of it wasn't so interesting to readers as just the truth of it, or the apparent truth, or just if it felt like anybody, like a real person.
I'm trying to figure out if this poem and the other very personal poems like it are really very personal to you, but you'd rather just not talk about the personal experiences that they came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Could you talk a little about that desire of yours, about where it comes from or what the meaning of that is? Why want to know as a reader?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And when I was reading your poems last night and thinking about what we were going to talk about in the interview, I was thinking, well, really, what makes Sharon Olds interesting to me? Do I really care what her parents were like, or do I really care that she writes good poetry? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I really care that she writes good poetry. But then I said, but I'm also interested in the parts of her life that inspired the poems that she writes about, and how those experiences helped her become the poet she is today.
Mm-hmm. I've had a very interesting experience in teaching, in that by the end of a semester, every woman writer asked me questions about privacy. Who to show the work to, who to stop showing it to, what the mother felt about it, what the lover had said, whether they were having writing block problems because of that. And none of the men. It was like perfect record. Oh, you know, 0, 16 or something, had asked me those questions. And it wasn't that I wasn't close to them. But for the women, it was a very important issue. And I know that among men poets whom I know who have written about family, I say to them, well, what do you say when you're asked about your specific, you know, child or parent? And they say, well, I'm not asked that much.
The last line in the poem is, do what you're going to do, and I will tell about it. Have you found in your life that telling about things, that making poems about things, gives you a certain power? Because finally, no matter what anyone has said or done to you or done in your presence, you have the power to tell it the way you perceive it and to give it its final interpretation, at least in your mind and in the life of that poem.
That's nice. I bet that's a strong unconscious involvement of mine in poetry. It's not very conscious. I mean, what I would perceive more is the pleasure of playing with language, the relief of speaking, the satisfaction of feeling the line turn at the end and come back to the left-hand margin, that kind of dance, that kind of physical dance of the poem. Sure, I bet a lot of it has to do with power. Consciously, no. A poet is not likely to feel powerful, I don't
right.
think. It's not a danger. It's not as bad a danger for us, but I'm sure that that's a satisfaction of it that I'm usually not conscious of, but that's there.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Sure.
And this is from an earlier volume of poems called The Dead and the Living, and the poem I'll ask you to read is called New Mother.
Yes. A week after our child was born, you cornered me in the spare room, and we sank down on the bed. You kissed me and kissed me. My milk undid its burning slipknot through my nipples, soaking my shirt. All week I had smelled of milk, fresh milk, sour. I began to throb. My sex had been torn easily as cloth by the crown of her head. I'd been cut with a knife and sewn, the stitches pulling at my skin. And the first time you're broken, you don't know you'll be healed again, better than before. I lay in fear and blood and milk while you kissed and kissed me, your lips hot and swollen as a teenage boy's, your sex dry and big, all of you so tender. You hung over me, over the nest of the stitches, over the splitting and tearing, with the patience of someone who finds a wounded animal in the woods and stays with it, not leaving its side until it is whole, until it can run again.
That's a beautiful poem. Do you remember writing the poem?
No. This is a long time ago now.
So is it like a found poem to you?
Well,
do you not remember it at all?
It was. Yeah.
And what did you think about when you read it?
I liked it. I liked the ending. When it came to the wounded animal, I was sort of rewriting there. I thought, oh, that's a little corny. And then when it came to the kissed and kissed, I've been writing so much love poetry. I'd say this poem is maybe 10 years old. I've been writing lots of love poems in the last, 5 years, 2 years, year. And I was just looking to see how guarded this was, how much it was going to keep itself to, how shy it was.
So how come you're writing a lot of love poems now?
I don't know. What a good question. Part of it, I think, sometimes when people say, how difficult to be a woman poet, I think of all the poems, however, that haven't been written because most of the poets weren't women. So that is poems that are written from, or as if from, personal experience. I mean, it's exciting to an artist to want and need to be writing about something that hasn't already been done a lot. So being a woman is a wonderful thing in that way, and especially with love poetry and erotic poetry, so little of it has been written by women or by men.
You know, there is a song, I think it's an Ira Gershwin lyric, that goes, what can you say in a love song that's never been said before?
Mm.
I think that's the problem, really, that a lot of love poetry is up against, that there's actually been so much of it, in spite of what you're saying.
Well, I think you're right. In any poetry about happiness, we talk about this in class a lot. Why are the poems about grief better poems, mostly?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we write about our joy? And certainly what I see in the progression of my books is many, many more poems of joy.
Okay, thank you so much for talking with us and reading some of your poems.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, Terry.
Sharon Old's latest collection of poetry, The Gold Cell, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us with an update on what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you covering the Armenian earthquake relief?
Well, we'll be hearing from Ann Cooper in Moscow about what the problems are that people are encountering there and what things the Soviets seem to need. We'll also be talking with Professor Mark Field, who's affiliated with the Russian Research Center at Harvard, an expert on the Soviet medical system, about the shortcomings of Soviet medicine that may be problematic over the next couple of weeks.
Robert, anything on cosmology on today's program?
Funny you should ask, Terry. actually, we do talk with a cosmologist. It's a theoretical physicist who addresses little questions like, is the universe getting bigger, smaller, staying the same, about the current happy state of cosmology.
Thank you. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the years, many of TV's families have reunited, for better or worse. The Addams Family, the family from Eight Is Enough, even the family from the show called Family. Now the Brady Bunch is back with A Very Brady Christmas. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold, like their mother. The youngest one in curls
is the story of a man named Brady.
Boy, does that bring back memories. From 1969 to 1974, the Brady Bunch started out each week with that same bouncy theme song. And each week I nearly killed myself diving to change channels as soon as I heard it. Back then, I hated the Brady Bunch for nothing. Now, at least, I can get paid for hating it. This weekend, CBS presents A Very Brady Christmas, a telemovie reuniting all the original cast members of the Brady Bunch. Well, all but one. Susan Olsen, who played Cindy, the littlest girl, is replaced in this new movie by Jennifer Runyon. But Eve Plum is back as Jan Brady, and I guess that's news, because she skipped the last Brady TV reunion, a 1977 variety series called The Brady Bunch Hour. But since I have trouble telling the Brady family from the Partridge Bunch, or is it the other way around, cast changes don't bother me. I'm more concerned that the script is co-written by Sherwood Schwartz, creator of Gilligan's Island. And what really gets me is that A Very Brady Christmas makes Schwartz's previous all-time low, a TV movie called The Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island, look like a masterpiece. A Very Brady Christmas starts out bad and keeps getting worse and finally reaches critical mass, a whole new level of terrible television. Here's a quick tour, but I ought to precede this with a warning. What you're about to hear is not for the squeamish, so you may want to turn down the volume for a minute. Still here? Okay, let's start with Robert Reed and Florence Henderson having a thoughtful conversation as the adult Bradys.
Where is my checkbook?
Right here.
Oh. You're gonna need that for your Christmas present.
Mike, you can't do this to me. You can't tell me you know what you're gonna get me and not tell me what it is.
Yes, I can. You know why?
No, why?
Because I'm mean and cruel and sadistic.
Yes, I know that. I just hope you're generous, too.
And here's the subtle way they set up the first flashback.
Remember our camping trip?
Which one?
The one where the boys almost got eaten by a bear.
Oh, how could I forget?
And here's the enlightened exchange between Peter Brady and his girlfriend, who's also his boss at work.
From 9 to 5, I may be the boss, but from 5 to 9...
I am.
I'd say it's about even, right?
Right.
Why do I watch this stuff? Because you never know how bad the bad is going to get. And in A Very Brady Christmas, it transcends badness. It's rancid, and the worst is saved for last. Daddy Brady gets trapped in a collapsed building, and the rest of the family gathers around outside and sings a Christmas carol for inspiration. A Very Brady Christmas could ruin these actors' careers. But, lucky for them, they don't have any.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Oh, come ye, oh, come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of ages. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Christ the Lord.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet the leaders of the anti-pop band Was Not Was. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Coasters, the group that in the 50s pioneered music for teenagers with songs like Yakety Yak and Charlie Brown. And book critic John Leonard reviews Sor Juana, The Traps of Faith, Octavio Paz's account of Sister Joan, a 17th century Mexican nun and poet. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Bergen and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.